Everybody loves a happy ending. But what makes a happy ending? At first glance, we might be tempted to think that it's something that can be found in the ending itself. If the hero achieved their goal, if they found what they were looking for, if they fixed what was broken, then it's a happy ending. So if the hero slayed the dragon, married the princess, and lived happily ever after, that is a happy ending. But what if we knew that the hero achieved this goal through some less than heroic choices? We might discover that despite his apparent success, we as the audience don't come away very happy with the ending. And that's because the stuff that happens in between matters. It's the choices that are made between point A and point B, the choices that actually result in point B, that is every bit as important as the resolution itself in determining whether or not we are satisfied with the ending. Whether or not it is a happy ending. This past Monday, as many of you know, New York Governor Kathy Hochul gave an executive order to mandate vaccination for New York healthcare workers. Those who failed to comply would not only be fired, they would be denied unemployment. The order was given in an effort to increase New York vaccination numbers by coercion. What if it worked? What if, in response to her mandate, those numbers reached 100%? Would that make for a happy ending? Would we laud her as a hero? No. She would still be a villain. And the ending would be as ominous as George Orwell's 1984. She achieved her goal, but the means that she used to get there, well, that changed everything. Why is that? Because at the end of the day, the ends do not justify the means. The ends do not justify the means. And yet we are prone to seek our ends by any means necessary. Why? It is a subject that we will pick up in our text today. We are still in Exodus 34, if you would like to look at it. Exodus 34, we have been looking at verses 6 and 7, where the Lord, in the self-revelation of His character to Moses, describes Himself in the following way. The Lord God, compassionate and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in loving kindness and truth, who keeps loving kindness for thousands, who forgives iniquity, transgression, and sin, yet He will by no means leave the guilty unpunished, visiting the iniquity of fathers on the children and the grandchildren to the third and fourth generations. That is who our God is. That is what He is like, and that is what we were created to be. It's who we are called to be. It's who we are destined to be. During the past 2 weeks in our pursuit of a better understanding of the character of God, as revealed to Moses, we have been confronted with the deficiencies of our own character. They are the things that make us the object of God's forgiveness in this text. And we find them listed in verse 7. They are iniquity, transgression, and sin. Now, we have looked at sin. We have looked at transgression already. We define sin as any failure of conformity to the character of God. And we use the image of a target to illustrate the character of God. And we talked about Matt Emmons, the Olympic shooter, competing for gold. He got the bullseye, but it didn't matter because he missed the mark. He sinned. He missed the mark and he hit another mark. He didn't hit the right target. Then we looked at transgression and we came to understand it as intentionally breaking trust. It's when you cross the line in a relationship. And we use the image of my dad in his bowling league. He got a strike, but it didn't matter because he transgressed. He crossed the line. Today we will look at the third and final description regarding our wicked characters, and that is iniquity. Iniquity. What is iniquity? I don't know about y'all, but when it comes to the three words, at least in this text, that one is the most mysterious to me. We are all very familiar with sin. You can't come, you know, don the doors of a church building and not at least come to some idea of what sin is talking about. And we might even hear transgression now and again in our normal discourse. Or at least we can kind of get there when we think about the word. But iniquity? What is iniquity? According to Merriam-Webster, the term refers to gross injustice or wickedness. Some other online dictionaries add immorality to the mix. Basically, it refers to bad stuff. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't find those definitions very helpful. I already know it refers to bad stuff. It doesn't really get me much closer to the mark. What are we really talking about? How is iniquity different from transgression? How is it different from sin? What makes this bad stuff distinct from the other bad stuff? Now, to figure that out, as you know, we're going to have to take a look at how it is used in the biblical text. In Exodus 34, the word that we find translated as iniquity is avon. Avon. And if you were to look up this Hebrew word in a Hebrew lexicon, you would find it variously translated as iniquity, guilt, punishment of iniquity, perversity, depravity, misdeed. It appears just over 230 times in the Old Testament. And when we look at its actual appearance in text, we'll find texts like Micah 2:1. Just listen to it. This is Micah 2:1. Woe to those who scheme iniquity, who work out evil on their beds. When morning comes, they do it, for it is in the power of their hands. So I think of an evil plot. I think of a scheme. I think of a true conspiracy, if you will. And we have more and more of those popping up in our own country to reference. It is a true conspiracy. Now, for our reference, it seems the difference between a conspiracy theory and a conspiracy fact is about 6 months. It's a conspiracy that turned out it's true. They really are plotting behind the scenes to do some particular act. I also find this term used in texts such as Isaiah 58, which I think gives us it paints a really nice picture of what we're looking at. Just listen to this. This is Isaiah 58, and I'm just going to read the first 8 verses. Behold, the Lord's hand is not so short that he cannot save, nor is his ear so dull that he cannot hear. But your iniquities have made a separation between you and your God. And your sins have hidden his face from you so that he doesn't hear. For your hands are defiled with blood and your fingers with iniquity. Your lips have spoken falsehood. Your tongue mutters wickedness. No one sues rightly and no one pleads honestly. They trust in confusion and speak lies. They conceive mischief and bring forth iniquity. They hatch adder's eggs and weave the spider's web. He who eats of their eggs dies, and from that which is crushed, a snake breaks forth. Their webs will not become clothing, nor will they cover themselves with their works. Their works are works of iniquity, and an act of violence is in their hands. Their feet run to evil, and they hasten to shed innocent blood. Their thoughts are thoughts of iniquity. Devastation and destruction are in their highways. They don't know the way of peace. There is no justice in their tracks. They've made their paths crooked. Whoever treads on them does not know peace. Now, one thing I like about this, and it's, you know, we just read in Micah, we're thinking of a conspiracy. We're thinking of something behind the scenes, a plot, a scheme, something, it's hidden. Here in this text, we find the iniquities are what is hiding them from God. Now, I cannot help but think of Adam and Eve, right? Adam and Eve, they eat of the fruit, their eyes are open, they know that they are naked, and the first thing they try to do is to hide, to conceal themselves. They're the ones that are separating themselves from God because they don't want to be exposed. They don't want to be found out. They're guilty. And that's how the word is translated sometimes. They are guilty. They feel like they need to be hidden, covered, concealed. You know, they need what is called an atonement, a covering, which God will provide in that text. They are seeds of the serpent. Aren't they? They have these little eggs they're putting out there, and when it breaks out, here comes a little snake. You know, they're producing other serpents. And all of their thoughts, they're these conniving, mischievous, evil actions. They cannot cover themselves with their works. That little fig leaf ain't going to work. It will not provide a covering for your sin, for your iniquity, for your transgressions. So I think of a text such as this. We also find it in narratives in the story. I think of Eli and his sons, which we will read about in 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel chapter 3. Let's listen to this. This is the Lord speaking to Samuel, but in verse 11, he tells Samuel, "Behold, I'm about to do a thing in Israel that at which both ears of everyone who hears it will tingle. In that day, I will carry out against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house from beginning to end. For I told him that I'm about to judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knew, because his sons brought a curse on themselves and he didn't rebuke them. Therefore, I have sworn to the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be atoned for by sacrifice or offering forever. You will not cover this up." What did they do? What was Hophni and Phinehas up to? You might recall, this was before the kings showed up. This is the days of the judges and the priests. And the high priest, he's the leader of it. He is the supreme court, the supreme judge. That's Eli. And his sons, then, they are priests in the land. They have a position of power, of prestige. And if we were to read about them in the previous chapter, 2 Samuel 2:12, it's going to say they're sons of Belial. They're seeds of the serpent. You got seeds of the serpent running the tabernacle. When people bring sacrifices, they take the part that's supposed to belong to the Lord for themselves. They take the women that are watching the doors to the tabernacle, the opening of it, and they're fornicating with them. They are seeds of the serpent. They are poster boys for what we might think of as wicked clergy. They are men of the cloth who are wolves in sheep's clothing. These are the first. So with this in mind, we can begin to see why some have come to the conclusion regarding this word, iniquity, that it's not really about a specific action per se. It's not the fornication, it's not the this bad thing or that bad thing, but rather the character of an action. It is the thought, it is the motivation that went into it, into the plotting, into the conniving, into the conceiving that produced this action. It's all the work bound up in it. So, while you could do something like take sin, for example, we looked at sin. Okay, your sin is a missing of the mark and a hitting of the other mark. You can sin unintentionally. Okay, there are certain things that God told Israel, do this, don't do that. You could accidentally do one. You sinned. Okay, that doesn't mean it was intentional. All the same, you sinned. You can't do that with iniquity. It's premeditated. There's a premeditation going on. Consider the words of David. This is Psalm 32. Psalm 32, I just want to look at the first five verses. A psalm of David. How blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. How blessed is the man whom the Lord does not impute iniquity, and in whose spirit there is no deceit. When I kept silent about my sin, my body wasted away through my groaning all day long. For day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My vitality was drained away as with the fever heat of summer. I acknowledged my sin to you, and my iniquity I did not hide. I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord, and you forgave the guilt of my sin. All right, David speaks of all our terms, iniquity, transgression, and sin in this text. But what I find interesting is how he uses them, particularly how he uses iniquity in that last line, verse 5. You couldn't see it probably because it's not rendered iniquity there. It's rendered guilt. It's rendered guilt. You forgave the guilt of my sin. You forgave the iniquity of my sin. So again, iniquity can be a certain aspect of sin. It is not, they are not synonymous terms. You forgave those wicked motives wrapped up in my sin that I did. The schemes that were in my heart that produced this action. Another detail worth noting in David's words is associated with iniquity. In this text, notice verse 2, it's parallel. It is, how blessed is the man whom the Lord does not impute iniquity, and in whose spirit there is no deceit. Well, here we are again. Deception. Hidden actions. You'll see the same thing in verse 5. David did not hide his sin. He acknowledges his sin, and my iniquity I did not hide. All right, so this, the concealment, he says, I went against that. I exposed my iniquity to you. The thing that I had hidden, and you were wearing me out with your hand heavy upon me, I opened it to the light of day. I came to you with it, Lord. So it tells me something about the character of this word in this text. The things that are going in it. You know, it's the thing that hides in the shadows. The thing that goes on behind the scenes, undercover. And while we're on the subject of David, let's consider what is likely going on behind this particular psalm. Let's look at another one, Psalm 51. In Psalm 51, your text will likely have a superscription at the top. From the choir director, a psalm of David when? When Nathan the prophet came to him after he had gone into Bathsheba. That psalm. Listen to it. Be gracious to me, O God, according to your loving kindness, your chesed. According to the greatness of your compassion, blot out my transgressions. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity. Cleanse me from my sin. For I know my transgressions, and my sin is ever before me. Against you, you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight, so that you are justified when you speak and blameless when you judge. Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin my mother conceived me. Behold, you desire truth in the innermost being, and in the hidden part you will make me know wisdom. Purify me with hyssop, and I shall be clean. Wash me, I shall be whiter than snow. Make me to hear joy and gladness. Let the bones which you've broken rejoice. Hide your face from my sins. Blot out my iniquities. David was, he was conceived in iniquity, and he has committed iniquity. Okay, what are we talking about here? What iniquity has he committed? Well, this is obviously the iniquity in the matter of Uriah, Because the superscription, hey, this is the psalm David came up when that day that the Lord sent Nathan to wear him out. So his iniquity is the iniquity in the matter of Uriah. Well, how is he conceived in iniquity? Oh. Well, was it something that his father and mother did that were wrong? Or is it something about David that has been true about David since the day of his birth? Now think of the various ways I've already mentioned this term is translated. Not just as iniquity or guilt or misdeed, but as depravity. A propensity to do a certain kind of thing. Says, that's been true about me from the day I came on the scene. And guess what? That thing came to fruition. That's what he's talking about. He came into this scene with what this term is going to mean. And then it gave birth. It came to fruition. Now, let's think about what took place with Uriah. Let's remind ourselves of the story. Think in context of the story here. 2 Samuel 11. Okay, David becomes king. Everything is going well. Saul's out of the place. He's having rest in the kingdom as he's conquering lands. And then in chapter 11, we find that it happened, verse 1, in the springtime when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the sons of Ammon and besieged Rabbah, but David stayed at Jerusalem. And now when evening came, David arose from his bed and walked around on the roof of the king's house, and from the roof he saw a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful in appearance. And so David sent and inquired about the woman, and one said, is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? And David sent messengers and took her. And when she came to him, he lay with her. And when she had purified herself from her uncleanness, she returned to her house. The woman conceived, and she sent and told David and said, I'm pregnant. Then David sent to Joab, saying, send me Uriah the Hittite. So Joab sent Uriah to David. And when Uriah came to him, David asked concerning the welfare of Joab and the people and the state of the war. And then David said to Uriah, go down to your house and wash your feet. And Uriah went out of the king's house, and a present from the king was sent for him. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord, and he did not go down to his house. Now when they told David, saying Uriah didn't go down to his house, David said to Uriah, have you not come from a journey? Why didn't you go down to your house? And Uriah said to David, the ark and Israel and Judah are staying in temporary shelters, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go to my house and eat and drink and lie with my wife? By your life and the life of your soul, I will not do this thing. And then David said to Uriah, stay here today also, and tomorrow I'll let you go. So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. And now David called him, and he ate and drank before him, and he made him drunk. In the evening he went out to lie on his bed with his lord's servants, but he didn't go down to his house. Now in the morning David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. And he had written in the letter saying, place Uriah in the front line of the fiercest battle and withdraw from him so that he may be struck down and die. And of course you know how the story unfolds. This exact thing takes place. Then David sends for Bathsheba and brings her into his house. Now I think about this, a couple observations regarding David's self-proclaimed iniquity. I think it's safe to say here that there was intentionality behind David's iniquity. He knew what he was doing. You say, well, how do you know he knew? Because he tried to hide it, to cover it up. Is that fair? If you're going out of your way to hide something, then you know that you've done something wrong. Okay, if I've got an email server over here and I'm smashing it to bits so people can't look into it, I probably have a guilty conscience about what might transpire with that. Things like that we're familiar with. Guilty conscience. He knew what he did was wrong. So there's intentionality here. There's also a conspiracy, a plot, a scheme. No, he's even got Joab, the commander of the army, involved to do his dirty work. And there is most certainly a downward trend. There is a downward trajectory. David starts off bad. He commits adultery with the wife of one of his soldiers while a soldier is out doing the battle on behalf of David. But he doesn't stop there. He tries to deceive the soldier so that the soldier won't know, and David will get away, and the soldier will raise his kid. That doesn't work. He gets him drunk, still doesn't work. He kills him. It just is getting worse and worse and worse. There's a downward trend to what's going on, a downward trajectory. Now, when I think about that, we could look at more uses of our word to continue to try to flesh this out, but we're going to take a shortcut instead. Because I think the most insightful clue that we can get into the meaning of this term and how we are to understand it and how it relates to us is derived from the root word that it comes from. And the root word of avon, iniquity, is the word ava. They always sound similar, right? Ava, avon. Ava is a term that means bent, twisted, crooked, perverse. So we find it in places like Psalm 38:6. I am bent over greatly and bowed down. Here the psalmist's back was upright, but it has become avod. It is bent now. Or you find it in Lamentations 3:9, after the destruction of Jerusalem, when Jeremiah is weeping over what has taken place, he says, God has blocked my ways with hewn stone. He has made my paths crooked. Jeremiah's path was once straight, but now it is avod, crooked. In Isaiah 24:1, we're told that, behold, the Lord lays waste to the earth, devastates it, distorts its surface, and scatters its inhabitants. The surface of the earth was flat, it was level, but now it is avod. It has become distorted. So I think of the literal sense, which indicates the opposite of something that is upright, that is straight, that is level. It is not that. It is the opposite of that. But I also think of how the term is applied figuratively as well. Consider again the words of the prophet Jeremiah. This is in the book of Jeremiah, chapter 3, verse 21. A voice is heard on the bare heights, the weeping and the supplications of the sons of Israel. Why? Because they have perverted their way, they have forgotten the Lord their God. They had known the way of life. Okay? They had a relationship with God, but now they abandoned it to pursue other gods. They had avod their way. So I think of this departure from the straight and narrow. They become crooked. So when I think of our word avon, and I think of how it relates to the word that it comes from, ava, bent and crooked, and I think of the way that we have been presenting, or I have at least presented, these three terms when we think about it, you know, the target, you're missing it with sin, or the line on the ground, you're crossing it, but you're still getting it. I think of this, and I'm more reminded of the story of William Tell. Do y'all know the story of William Tell? Most of you are probably familiar. There's a Swiss town that was under oppression from a particular tyrant. And one day the tyrant sets up a pole in the public square with his hat on it, and he demands that everyone who comes to the town's got to bow to it. He's kind of like his own little Nebuchadnezzar. He's got that kind of thing going on. You come to the town, you come to the square, you got to bow down to this hat. Bow to it. But a famous hunter who lived nearby named William Tell, he wasn't having it. He wouldn't bow down. He's not doing that. He thinks it's ridiculous. And when the tyrant found out, he decided to make an example of William. So he orders that William's son be brought to the square and an apple put on his head. And he ordered William to shoot the apple off his head with an arrow, or he's going to slay the boy for William's rebellion. Now there are several variants to the story. You pick the one you like. I don't know which one is the true one, but the one that I like is this one. The tyrant, knowing that William was good with the crossbow, he is a renowned hunter in the land. That's why the whole scenario is set up. But he knows he's good. So he wants to cause him a little bit of grief, or not a little bit, now wanting to cause him grief instead of allowing him to take this crossbow that he's good with. He says, you can't use that. You have to use mine. But the crossbow that he gives him is intentionally sighted to miss 2 inches low, so that if William hits the mark according to his sights, he will kill his son. The crossbow is not accurate. The arrows do not go where you aim. But in that particular version of the story, William is allowed to practice just a moment ahead of time. And he notices that while it misses the mark, the arrows would land in the same place every time. So we would say that the crossbow was not accurate, it was precise. It had precision. All right, it put the arrows in the same place, just not the place that you were looking. So by compensating for the crooked sight, William was able to shoot the apple off his son's head and deliver them from the tyrant. You say, okay, well, Caleb, that's great. How on earth does that relate to iniquity? We humans have a problem that started at the fall. It's what David talked about, right? I was brought forth in iniquity. Our sights are off. Okay, we do what is right in our own eyes, and it puts us all on a downward trajectory from the very beginning. So our motives, our goals, our desires are twisted. They are crooked. We are just bent. We are bent, and so are the paths that we take to achieve these goals. Like the New York governor that we've already mentioned. Please get the vaccine. It will save your life. And if you don't, I'll make sure to ruin your life personally. Now, is the governor concerned with the health of her citizens? Or is she concerned with making herself look better? Does she have another agenda? Seems like the only thing that the vaccine may give full protection of for the New York citizens is the governor. And even then, they'll probably need boosters for that too, for too long. It's crooked. It's wrong. Evil. Iniquity. She is seeking ends regardless of the means. We are bent too. Our hearts are prone to wander. We are prone to get off course. Even when we seek to do good, we will find ourselves cutting corners if our desires are jeopardized. Problem is, more often than not, we're not even seeking the good. We want, we covet, we desire, so we plot, we scheme, and we will even do unspeakable things if we really believe that our ends are worth attaining. And there, you know, whatever it takes, I'll get it. But at the end of the day, the ends do not justify the means. We cannot say, let us do evil that good may come. You've ruined the whole thing. The only thing that we can bring about through our own efforts of evil is evil. Period. It's all tainted. It's done. Now we know that God is greater than us, that God is beyond us. He is sovereign. He's running the things. He has a plan for what He's going to do in the story, how He's going to solve the problem through His Son, through a nation. And as we've watched that story, we've even seen people try to bring about evil and God use that evil for good, have we not? We saw how He overcame the brothers of Joseph to save the nation. What y'all meant for evil, God meant for good. Or I even think when our Lord is nailed to the cross by the hands of wicked men, and yet it is the preordained plan of God for how He's going to solve our problem in this story. We can't bring about good through evil. But even though we are enemies of God, He's still going to win. He's going to accomplish His good purposes in spite of our evil in working against Him. So I think about that. We'll have a lot more to say about this word. It's going to tie into the rest of this text. It's going to tie in perhaps a surprising way that will change the way that you're going to view your relationship to God and your relationship to others. But we're going to have to hold off on that till next week. So what about us? Now, I've already mentioned we are all far from perfect. None of us are straight as an arrow. We all miss the mark. We all are habitual line crossers. We are as crooked as a hockey stick. But we serve a great God. He can hit a straight lick with a crooked stick. He takes us as we are and then makes us as He is through the gift of His Son. And as He has given us the self-revelation of Himself through His story, we see how He is leading His story towards a happy ending. And as we find our place in His story, you know, we abandon this fiction that is our story where we're the hero, where we're the main character, and we're seeking our ends by any means necessary. We abandon that. We join His story, and it's through that that we will get this happy ending. And we're going to find out exactly how He does it in relation to our problems and our iniquity next time.